I welcome you to Sri Radha Gopinath Mandir on the blessed occasion of the appearance of Sri Ramchandra. Today, for those of you who were fortunate enough to see on our altar, Sri Gopal has assumed the form of Lord Ramchandra, delivering Ahalya. How many of you are knowing this story? Does anyone know this story? Please say Hari Bol if you know this story. Would you like me to speak something? I will briefly give a preface to the story. In the Treta Yuga, the great King Dasarath had his kingdom in Ayodhya. From there he was ruling the world. A great sadness was permeating his mind. And the citizens were very much aware of it. For a great personality, they are sad when they neglect or offend someone. But Dasarath Maharaj never offended or neglected anyone. He was like a loving father and servant to everyone in his kingdom. A great personality feels sad when he sees others in distress. But because Dasarath Maharaj was such a perfect servant of the society, by his example and by his teachings, all of his kingdom was God conscious. They were pious. They were prosperous. And because of their natural devotion to God, everyone was happy. A great person feels very depressed when he or she commits sinful activities. But Dasarath Maharaj was quite sinless. He was pious and good to all. No one could conquer him. Why was he so sad? Because in his heart of hearts, he understood that in the Raghu dynasty, great kings like Ikshvaku, descendants of Surya, they ruled over the kingdom for many ages. They ruled their citizens with piety and invested in everyone's heart a sense of spirituality. It was his duty to his forefathers, to God, and to all of his citizens to continue this great dynasty. However, despite many attempts for many years, he did not have a single son. Dasarath Maharaj was getting old. He knew that soon the time would come where to set an example for his citizens, he was to become a vanaprastha and enter into the forest. But how could he do that if he did not have a son to inherit the throne? Thus, Dasarath's sadness was based on his compassion to his citizens and his very, very deep sense of responsibility to his gurus and forefathers. Dasarath Maharaj called an assembly in his palace, and there were representatives of all the different categories of the society, from the common people, the simple workers, the wealthy merchants, the great warriors, and the learned Brahmins. His high priests, headed by Vasishtha Muni, and other ministers were all gathered. He explained to them that the only way that I could pacify this burning anguish in my heart is to satisfy the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Vishnu. And by his mercy, perhaps a son could be born who could rule the kingdom of Ayodhya. Vasishtha Muni, as well as Sumantra, his minister, reminded him. Vasishtha Muni said, I have a hermitage on the outskirts of Ayodhya. Once the great sage Sanat Kumar came to visit me, and he told me that someday there will be a horse sacrifice, and the great sage Rishyashringa will be the head priest of that sacrifice. And the fruit of that sacrifice is the Supreme Personality of Godhead will appear on earth as the son of King Dasarath. So they prepared the sacrifice. First they have to get a horse that was consecrated with various mantras and rituals. And then for 1 year, that horse had to travel throughout the world with many, many of the soldiers of Dasarath along with him. And all the kings in all the provinces that that horse would run had to either accept Dasarath Maharaj and agree to come to the yajna or fight battle. And only when there was no dispute in anyone's mind could they perform this yajna. A year went by and the horse returned along with the soldiers. Everywhere they went, they accepted Dasarath as the emperor. So the yajna was being performed. They brought Rishyashringa, who happened to be married to Dasarath Maharaj's only daughter, Shanta. He was living in the Anga province, where the king Romapad was residing. Rishyashringa was very, very pure in heart. Many days of yajna passed, and at the very culmination, when everything was perfectly auspicious, they offered oblations to the various demigods. At that time, the devatas appeared to the great sages and people with the sensitivity to see them. And they all prayed to Lord Brahma. Praying to Brahma that we are all in such distress because the great Rakshasa demon, Ravana, is terrorizing all directions. He has already defeated many of the gods, and he's about to conquer the whole heavenly world. You gave him these powerful benedictions by which he cannot be defeated. Please save us. At that time, Lord Brahma, in his heart of hearts, understood the only refuge is Vishnu. He intensely meditated on the lotus feet of Vishnu and prayed for him to save the world. At that time, Lord Narayan descended from Vaikuntha on Garuda. And Brahma and the Devatas appealed to him that Ravana was given the benediction that he would not be killed. He could not be killed or even defeated by anyone. However, considering human beings and earthly animals so insignificant, he didn't even consider asking benediction to be immune from them. So, dear Lord, if you appear as the son of Dasarath Maharaj, as a human being, then we will all be delivered, because then you could kill Ravana, who has made everyone in all directions cry. Lord Vishnu, being worshipped by the Devatas with great devotion, he told them that I will appear. I will appear with three of my personal expansions as the sons of Dasarath to fulfill your desire. But all of you should help me. Ravana never asked for a benediction against humans or animals. So you should all expand yourselves as monkeys and populate various parts of the world to assist me in this mission. Then Vishnu disappeared, and the Devatas disappeared. It was time for the final oblation of the yajna. Rishyashringa chanted the auspicious mantra, and when he poured ghee into the fire, out from the fire came a beautiful celestial person. His body was glowing. It was effulgent. He was carrying a golden pot filled with celestial nectar. He approached Dasarath and handed him the golden pot, instructing him to have it drunk, the contents drunk by his wives, and soon they would bear the Supreme Personality of Godhead to be his child. Dasarath Maharaj, with great humility, folded palms, offered prayers to this divine person, accepted the pot, circumambulated him, and within a moment that person just entered again into the fire to disappear. Dasarath Maharaj gave half of the content to Kaikeyi, his senior most wife. And then he gave other half, to Kausalya. He gave to Kausalya, his senior most wife. And then he gave another portion to Kaikeyi. Kaikeyi and Kausalya both gave a part of theirs to Sumitra. So she had two portions. They drank it. And very soon after, each of the three wives of Dasarath felt the presence of the divine forms of the Lord within them. Their bodies radiated with joy. After some months, the whole kingdom of Ayodhya sing that after all these years, Dasarath Maharaj's desire was being fulfilled. All three of his wives were bearing children. The whole of Ayodhya, the whole of the kingdom, was simply and anticipating in utter eagerness the coming of the Lord. It was on everyone's mind. It was in everyone's heart. It was spoken on everyone's lips. In great feeling of separation and anticipation, everyone waited and waited on this day of Ram Navami. The Supreme Personality of Godhead appeared from the womb of Kausalya as Lord Sri Ramchandra. And soon after, Kaikeyi gave birth to Bharat, and Sumitra gave birth to Lakshman and Shatrughna. The beauty of these children was extraordinary, especially Sri Ram. His complexion was like a finely polished celestial emerald, or sometimes described like very fresh, fine kusha grass. He had eyes that were like blooming lotus petals. His every limb was so charming to the heart of everyone who witnessed him. He became the very life and soul of all of the citizens. And who could possibly try to comprehend the happiness of Dasarath and Kausalya? Although he was the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who possessed all spiritual opulences, they considered him to be their own little helpless child. As the children grew up, from infancy, Lakshman became completely attached to serving Ram in every way. In fact, practically 24 hours a day he was at Ram's side, just ready and willing to do anything and everything for Sri Ram. The attachment of these two brothers became so deep with love that Ram would not even eat or sleep unless Lakshman was at his side. And Shatrughna performed the same loving service to Bharat. They were inseparable friends. As the children grew up, this is becoming a little long preface. I hope you do not mind. As the children grew up, everything they were taught, they learned so expertly. Sri Ramchandra and his brothers became expert at bow and arrow and various other types of weapons. They became completely expert in all other sorts of military skills and arts because they were trained to be kings. Every subject about statesmanship, about management and organization, about properly serving the citizens, philosophy of religion from the holy scriptures. They learned everything so well. Dasarath Maharaj was simply waiting for the day that Ram could get old enough so that he could make him the prince regent and later enter into the forest after coronating Ram as king. And this was the constant talk and meditation of everyone. When Ram was hardly 15 or 16 years old, He was so charming, so absolutely obedient to all of his superiors. All of his behavior was completely humble and free of any ego or prestige. He was the well-wishing friend of everyone. He was a compassionate servant of even the most downtrodden of the people of Ayodhya. He did not discriminate. He was kind and loving and gentle to everyone. At that time, the great sage Vishwamitra came to the outskirts of Ayodhya. Dasarath Maharaj came to greet him. He offered Vishwamitra Muni a very beautiful seat, washed his feet, offered him nice foods, served him and worshipped him. This was the culture of the Vedic times, that even the greatest, most powerful kings always took the most humble position of servant of the great saints, because they understood that real power and real wealth is not of the world. Real power and wealth is in spiritual realization. It was with this mood, not just as a ritual, but from the heart, that the great kings honored the Brahmins and the sages. Maharaj Dasarath, with such a grateful heart, he said to Vishwamitra Muni that we are so fortunate you have come to make our kingdom into a place of pilgrimage. Vishishta Muni explained some of the history of Vishwamitra. What an incredible person. What immense tapasya he had performed. Dasarath Maharaj was so happy. He said, "Oh great sage, my life is yours. My body is yours. Whatever I have is yours. Any way I can serve you, you ask me and I will serve you. I promise you this." Vishwamitra Muni replied, "Do you give your word that whatever I ask you will fulfill?" And Dasarath Maharaj said, "Yes, I give my word. It is my duty." Vishwamitra Muni gazed very gravely into the eyes of Maharaj Dasarath. And he said, "At my ashram, Siddhashram, two demoniac rakshasas named Subahu and Maricha are spoiling my sacrifices." Now, I have great spiritual and mystic powers. Just by chanting mantras, I could kill those demons. However, being the high priest of the yajñas, if I become angry, the whole yajña is spoiled. And also, I'm a Brahmin. I'm not supposed to be killing demons. This is the service of Kshatriyas. I request that you give me your eldest son, Ram, to come to kill these demons. Dasarath Maharaj was hit as if a thunderbolt had crashed upon him. His son was not even 16 years old. As far as he was concerned, he had not yet finished his lessons of learning weapons, and he never even got in a fight yet. He was never even subjected to a war yet. He was inexperienced. How could he fight these deadly, blood-sucking, man-eating rakshasas? Impossible. No, no way. He said, I will personally lead all of my armies to your ashram. And I will destroy these demons. But not Ram. He's just a boy. Tell me, who is this Maricha and Subahu? Vishwamitra Muni explained, they are two of the main generals of Ravana. As soon as the name Ravana hit the heart of Dasarath, he gasped. He said, no one can stand before Ravana. He's been given infallible boons by Lord Brahma and Lord Shiva. I have heard stories about him. Even my own ancestors have been devastated by him. How could my tender, young, inexperienced son stand against the armies of Ravana? I will go. I will go. And even though I will lose the battle, let me and all my armies die. But please spare Ram. Dasarath Maharaj, his heart was palpitating. Can you imagine? Years and years and years he longed for a son. He finally got a son that he was absolutely attached to with his heart, body, mind, and soul. And now the sage is asking to take him away to fight with Ravana's people. Dasarath pleaded, and Vishwamitra Muni, being a sadhu, responded by staring at Dasarath with red eyes of anger. He didn't say a word. He just gazed at Dasarath. And practically everyone in the entire courthouse was trembling with fear. And then Vishwamitra spoke with a very thunder-like, deep voice. He said, you have given your word. You, the descendant of Raghu Ikshvaku, you are going to destroy the reputation and the integrity of your entire dynasty. You will bring blasphemy to your whole race if you tell a lie to a sadhu. Will you tell this lie in disgrace your whole kingdom and all of those great souls who were kings before you, who laid down their lives to give integrity to their dynasty? At that time, Vasishtha Muni took Dasarath aside. He said, Maharaj, do not get Vishwamitra Muni angry. If he curses you, everything is finished. He's about to curse you. Don't you see what's happening? Let me tell you a secret. Your son Ram is the supreme personality of Godhead. You have nothing to fear. He could easily kill these rakshasas. And besides that, Vishwamitra Muni is so powerful. If he's there to protect your son, no harm can possibly come upon him. Now immediately give him your son. Dasarath Maharaj offered Sri Ram to the feet of Vishwamitra Muni. And Ramchandra, very happily, with the order of his father, departed from Ayodhya. And of course, Lakshman followed right behind. As they were wandering through the forest, they came to a very interesting sight. Sri Ramchandra told to Vishwamitra. He said, the whole forest is so beautiful and so nice. Why is it that all of a sudden this particular section that we have come to seems like it's utterly devastated? There's no life here. There's nothing. What's happened here? It's just in ruins. Vishwamitra Muni explained that there is a Rakshashi, a female demon named Tadaka. Yes? And she has plundered this place. She has terrorized everyone here. At one time, this was an affluent, prosperous, beautiful town. Even the celestial demigods, rishis, saints, and wealthy people would come here because it was such a beautiful oasis. However, this Tadaka, she is the mother of Maricha. And one time, her husband, and actually she was born of a yaksha, and she was very, very beautiful. Very beautiful. And she had great powers. But one time her husband attacked Agastya Muni, and Agastya Muni, by his mystic powers, killed her husband. So she became so angry, she and her son both attacked Agastya Muni. And Agastya Muni cursed her that she would be the personification of ugliness. Which is, ladies don't like these types of curses. And she would just be a reservoir of demoniac qualities. So from that time on, this Tadaka has just been terrorizing this neighborhood. Now, Ram, why don't you free her from her sins and free the forest from her terrorism? I know you're sentimental toward women, because women should always be protected and respected, but this is not an ordinary woman. She is cruel and causing great pain to all others. When Ramchandra was given the order by Vishwamitra Muni, he pulled the string of his bow. It made such a reverberation that the whole forest trembled. And Tadaka, she became so outraged to hear that anyone could dare to come into her forest. Vishwamitra Muni told Ram, beware, she has great mystic powers. She could do all kinds of terrible things. So all of a sudden, clouds started forming in the sky. And then she just, all of a suddenly, just screamed and attacked them. Then she disappeared. And they saw she was in front of them and screaming at them. Then she was on both sides of them. Then she was above them. Then she was behind them. And from above, she started throwing massive rocks like mountain peaks. Ramchandra, with his bows and arrows, he told Lakshman, you just be patient. I will do this. He just broke all the mountain peaks to powder. She was blood and pus and wild animals. She was just conjuring up all kinds of horrible things and just throwing them at Ram. And Ram was just dispelling all of these illusions with his arrows. Tadaka became so angry that she herself appeared. And Ramchandra, with an arrow, cut off both of her arms. Screaming violently, she assumed a massive, gigantic form and ran to Sri Ram. With one arrow, it entered into her chest and
pierced her heart, and she fell down to the ground, dead. Thank you very much. It is interesting that the first demon Ram killed was, and the first demon Krishna killed was, Hariva. This is not that they were biased against women. Ram taught the world how to respect and honor all women. But we should not be caste conscious. A person must be evaluated by their qualities, not simply by their external appearances. If a Brahmin acts in a sinful or a inappropriate way, that is not a Brahmin, although they may be born in Brahman. Similarly, the Bhagavatam describes if a person born in Chandala family is sincerely chanting the holy names and living by Brahman principles, that person is not only to be respected as Brahman, but can be accepted as guru, and he could deliver the whole world. Haridas Thakur example. He was born in untouchable family by social standards, but Advaita Prabhu, the leader of all the Brahmins, said, by feeding you, I am feeding millions and millions of Brahmins because you are the best of all. So the Lord reciprocates with a particular person's qualities, desires, and state of consciousness. Next, they came to Siddhashram, the place of Vishwamitra Muni. By the way, in that place, as soon as Taraka was killed, then all nice animals and birds and sages all started living there very happily. At Siddhashram, so many thousands and thousands of disciples of Vishwamitra Muni were there. They were chanting mantras, they were doing yajnas, they were performing meditation, they were chanting God's names. It was a beautiful spiritual environment. And they all came forward to greet their Gurudev, who appeared with these two beautiful young princes. But Sri Ram was very eager to perform his service. In fact, the next day, Vishwamitra Muni said, we will begin our yajna. And as the yajna began, Vishwamitra Muni sat in meditation near the fire, totally immersed in samadhi, listening to the other Brahmins chanting their mantras in glorification of the Supreme Lord. Ram asked Vishwamitra Muni, when do we get to kill these demons? And Vishwamitra Muni didn't say anything. So some of the other disciples said, he's in samadhi, he's in meditation. He will not speak a word for the next 6 days. But I will tell you this. For the first 5 days of the yajna, everything goes nice. But on the sixth day, Maricha and Sabahu will come to terrorize us. That is the time. So the yajna went on very nicely for 5 days. And on the sixth day, the sky became black. And there was horrible howling and shrieking sounds. Maricha and Subahu, with an entire army of horrible rakshasas, attacked. First, they just started throwing blood and pus and stool and dead bodies and severed heads and arms and legs everywhere. And as all this rain of horrible, abominable substance was pouring from the sky, they came and they were just running and just terrorizing and killing and eating and screaming. Really, picture this scene. It was horrible. And all the sages just ran to the side. Vishwamitra Muni looked at Sri Ram and said, "Now, kill them." Hare Krishna.
Ramchandra,
he saw that they had tremendous mystical powers. They could perform great illusions and what ordinary men would call miracles.
Sri Ram took one arrow.
It went into the chest of Maricha and threw him back 800 miles into the ocean. But he lived.
And then Subahu became ferociously angry. And he attacked with all of his soldiers, and it was really a good fight. There were so many of them, and they were shooting thousands and thousands, hundreds and thousands of arrows at a time from all directions, from these Rakshasas were coming at Ram. And his arrow, it looked like a circle, his bow. It just never stopped moving. He was shooting so fast. And he was shooting one arrow. As soon as it left his bow, it would expand itself into 1,000 arrows. It's an incredible fight. And ultimately, Ram shot an arrow into the chest of Subahu, and it cut his heart into pieces, and he fell to the ground dead. And then Ramchandra shot thousands and thousands. Actually, he called an arrow of Agni, and that pierced and burned the heart of Subahu. Then he did an arrow with the mantra of Vayu, and a massive wind came out of the arrows, massive winds. And it was just cutting all of the Rakshasas to pieces like a windstorm. And those who survived just got blown away. Shri Ramchandra Bhagavan ki.
Vishwamitra Muni was very proud of his two students.
In fact, Vishwamitra Muni, while they were in the forest one day, he trained Ram and Lakshman in the various mantras to invoke the weapons of the gods. He said, these mantras, he said, they are so powerful, greater than any weapons of this mortal world. Vishwamitra Muni taught the various mantras that invoke the weapons of Brahma, Vishnu, Shiva, and the various other devatas. And Ramchandra listened very carefully. And after Vishwamitra Muni explained this, all of those weapons appeared before Ram in their personified ethereal forms and promised Ram, whenever you chant the mantra, we will be there to fight for you.
So after finishing the yajna nicely, the sages continued, and the yajna was auspicious.
Vishwamitra Muni then told Ram that I want to take you on a special excursion to Mithila. Mithila is the kingdom of the great Janak Maharaj. There, it is a beautiful, beautiful kingdom of piety and pure religion. It is an opulent place because King Janak is a great saint. The bow of Shiva has been there for many generations. I want to show you that bow.
He took them deeper into the forest. They came to the river Ganga.
There at the Ganga, Ramchandra requested Vishwamitra Muni to explain to him the origin and history of Ganga Devi. In beautiful Sanskrit poetry, Vishwamitra Muni described
for many days the origin, the history, and the glories of Ganga, the sacred river. Then they came to the outskirts of Mithila.
Suddenly, this beautiful forest appeared before them. But there was no one in it. Lord Sri Ram was very sensitive. He inquired from Vishwamitra Muni, "How is this? I can feel that this is a very sacred hermitage. Very holy place. This is the type of place that so many great saints and rishis would be dwelling. But I do not see anyone here. Not a single soul. Can you please explain to me?"
Vishwamitra Muni explained
that what you are saying is true. This was one of the most beautiful, holy hermitages in all the world. The great sage Gotama Rishi lived here, along with his noble and pious wife Ahalya. Together here they performed many years of tapasya and very deep devotion activities. They worship the Lord with their hearts and souls here. Even the great devatas of the higher worlds honored and worshiped this place as the home of Gotama Rishi. Ahalya was so very beautiful, like no other lady. Indra, the lord of the region of Swarka, he became very deeply attracted to her. So he disguised himself by his supernatural powers to have an identical form as Gotama Rishi. And when Gotama Rishi went to the Ganga to take his bath, Indra appeared and spoke very, very romantic words. And thus, he and Ahalya performed a sinful act. As Indra was leaving, going down the path, who do you think he saw? It was Gotama Rishi. Gotama Rishi understood by his divine vision exactly what had happened. "Indra, it is you, and you have committed a great sinful activity. And not only that, but you did it in my name, with my form. How abominable, how disgusting." And he cursed Indra in a very unique way that we do not have to discuss in today's class. And then he cursed Ahalya that you have performed this immoral act. You will not be able to eat. You will not be able to breathe. You will not be able to drink. I condemn you to the form of a stone. Now Ahalya and Indra fell at Gotama Rishi's feet and begged for forgiveness. Gotama Rishi made some adjustments in Indra's curse. To Ahalya, he said, "For a long time, you will have to remain here in full consciousness, with your mind fixed in expectation
for the Lord to come.
When Lord Sri Ram, the son of Dasarath, comes to this forest, the dust of his lotus feet will deliver you.
And then you will be free of all sins, and you will attain the ultimate perfection of life. So from this day on, you simply remain in fixed meditation on the dust of the lotus feet of the Lord, just waiting for that dust to deliver you.
Gautam Rishi then disappeared and went elsewhere to perform his tapasya. And Ahalya took the form of stone, waiting for the dust of the lotus feet of the Lord. This is important for all of us to understand, that when we commit sinful activities, which all of us have done, when we commit such mistakes that are offenses to other living beings, to moral principles, and to the Lord Himself, then there must be sinful reactions that come upon us. But how should we deal with these sinful reactions? This is a great lesson that must be meditated upon. Every one of us is enduring the results of sinful activities. That is why we suffer. Even great devotees, even a great devotee like the wife of Gautam Rishi, made a serious mistake in her sense of repentance. She took a very, very humble position. Yes, I have sinned. Yes, I have done wrong. I am most fallen. I am most unfortunate. And in that state of great humility, Ahalya fixed her mind unwavering on the lotus feet of the Lord. This is the process of yoga. The path of purification is to have determination, to have fixed purpose on our goal.
Vyavashayatmaka budhir ekeha kurunandana bahushaka yanantasya budhayo vyavashayanam. Krishna tells in Bhagavad Gita that those who are on my path, they are resolute in purpose and their aim is one. The minds of those, the intelligence of those who are irresolute is many, many branched.
Krishna consciousness means to fix our mind on Krishna. And what does this mean? This means we have to take a vow of determination. Today, some of you have taken vows of initiation. Can you raise your hands if you took initiation today? You have taken vows. What is the purpose of these vows? That we very seriously fix our consciousness on our goal and live a strict life. No illicit sex, no intoxication, no gambling, no meat eating. Guarding against the 10 offenses to the holy name. Chanting the holy names at least 16 rounds minimum every day. During initiation, devotees would say to Srila Prabhupada, I will chant 16 rounds every day. And Prabhupada would look and say, minimum, no maximum. The perfection of life is satatam kirtayantam, to always be chanting the holy names. We take a vow to not blaspheme others, to not criticize others. We have to be determined. Krishna explains in Bhagavad Gita, there's no question of yoga without controlling the mind and the senses. And how do we control? We must have determination. Today, the most popular spiritual leaders tell the disciples or their followers, don't try to go against your natural sensory mental inclinations. Just be what you are and who you are and do as you like and do this meditation or do this asana or meditate on your breathing and it's all right, it's all right. That is not yoga according to the Gita. You will achieve some peace if you do that, no doubt. But real yoga, Krishna explains in Gita, that you have to control all your senses on all sides by your mind. Arjuna said, the mind is more difficult to control than the raging wind. How am I possibly going to control it? And Krishna said, by constant practice and detachment. That's how. He didn't say, just let it go wherever it wants to go and give a little donation somewhere and do meditation. What is meditation? Meditation means to actually fix your mind on the Lord. But in order for that meditation to be real, there has to be determination. Tani saravani samyamya yukta asita matpara. There are six senses, the eyes, the nose, the flesh, the ears, the tongue. And there's the mind. Krishna says one must restrain the mind and senses and fix the consciousness upon me. That is yoga. That was Ahalya. She was determined. But because her husband was a great Vaishnav, Gautam Rishi, she was not just meditating on an impersonal void. She was not just meditating on breath coming in and out. She was not just meditating on a light bulb. She was meditating on her only hope, her only shelter, the lotus feet of Sri Ram. Because Gautam Rishi told her, only the dust of the feet of Ram can deliver you. So on her husband's command, she spent 24 hours a day for thousands of years just meditating in separation from the lotus feet of Ram. Man manabhava madbhakto madhyajim nam namaskuru me mame vaishasi satyam te pratijani priyoshime. Always think of me, become my devotee, worship me and offer your homage unto me. In this way you will come to me without fail. This story is evidence of this fact. Now please do not think that Krishna consciousness means being a stone and just determination, determination. No, I will not do anything except think of Krishna. It's not like that. Kevala Ananda Kanda. Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu taught that devotional service is joyful, but there must be determination. We must have a fixed purpose to always remember Krishna by seeing the beauty of his form, by meditating, by being with wonderful devotees, by taking prasad, by hearing Hari Katha, by doing wonderful service, by coming to beautiful temples, by speaking the Lord's glories, by hearing the Lord's glories, by dancing and by chanting his holy name. It is a happy life. It is a blissful life. It's actually the best life. People who were addicted to all kinds of sense gratification, who had all kinds of money and all kinds of facilities living in America, but they were just depressed. Some priests and professors, they used to regularly say to Prabhupada, that we don't understand. Your followers, they're so bright-faced. They're so happy. Everyone's thinking, give me money, give me illicit sex, give me intoxication, give me television, give me cricket matches or basketball matches, give me gambling, and give me all of these things, and then we'll be happy. If we don't have these things, how will we live? And these devotees actually, with great determination, gave up all of these things. But because they utilized their mind and their senses in such determination to chant the holy names, to hear the glories of the Lord, to live with devotees of the Lord, to pray to the Lord, to worship to the Lord, to serve the Lord in everything they did, they were liberated. They were blissful. Just look at Shamsundar Prabhu. So happy. As long as we have that determination to replace the negative with the positive. You see, impersonal philosophers, their actual ideal is to totally empty the mind and the senses of all thoughts, all actions, all everything, and just be. So therefore, such spiritual teachers, they know no one can do it. Klesho dikataraste shamavyaktashakta jetasam. Krishna says it's very, very difficult to worship the impersonal, to fix your mind on the impersonal. So the impersonalists, they understand, if they tell everyone to empty their minds and empty their senses and just live rigid lives like Shankaracharya taught, they'll be out on the street. They won't have any followers. So therefore, what's the alternative? Just do what you want and think what you like and be what you are and just meditate. And be nice. Just be a nice person, that's all. But when you understand the true principles of bhakti, we understand how actually we could replace all of these negative desires and negative actions with very, very deeply satisfying positive thoughts and actions. By filling our lives with devotional service to the personality of Godhead. And chanting his holy name.
Krishna, 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 Hare Hare, Hare Ram, Hare Ram,
Ram Ram, Hare Hare. Man mana mad bhakto majjajim namamaskuru mame vaishasi chattham te pratijani priyoshine. Krishna's promise. Always think of me, become my devotee, worship me, and offer your homage unto me. In this way you will come to me without fail. So yes, we must have faith in this. To the degree we have faith in this, practicing Krishna consciousness becomes very easy and pleasurable. To the degree we have doubts, things become complicated and difficult. In the association of sincere devotees, that faith awakens and becomes stronger and stronger and stronger in our lives. So Ahalya, she fixed her mind on the lotus feet of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Sri Ram, with great determination. Her mind was like a rock, unmovable from her meditation on the Lord. That was her determination. In regard to Raghunath Das Goswami, it explains that he followed the regulative principles of offering obeisances to thousands of Vaishnavas every day, chanting 2 lakhs of names every day, offering obeisances to the Supreme Lord every day. In his humility, he was so strict, it is explained that his regulative principles were like the lines in stone.
그리고
that is the sign of our sincerity. And that's where ecstasy is. Ecstasy is in making sacrifices for a higher cause. That's where real pleasure is. Pleasure is not in just selling out your morals, your ethics, and your spiritual values for some temporary enjoyment. Krishna says, such enjoyment tastes like nectar in the beginning, but what does it taste like in the end?
Much louder, please.
Poison! Poison!
Yes, very good.
Tastes like poison in the end. So a devotee of the Lord must have very, very deep sincerity to somehow or other keep one's mind fixed on the Lord. And that was Ahalya. Rupa Goswami says surrender means enthusiasm and patience. The Lord promises, if we just chant His holy name and live as a humble servant, we will go back to His abode and see Him face to face. Of this there is no doubt. That is the power of bhakti. But it takes time. It's not that just living a pious life of service and chanting according to our regulation for 10 or 20 or 30 years, we're going to see Krishna dancing with gopis. It may take our whole life, but that's not much time. With faith, with patience, and with enthusiasm, we carry on with our devotional service. That was Ahalya's vow. She was humble. She was repentant, and she was fixed in her consciousness. When Vishwamitra Muni explained the history of Ahalya, Lord Sri Ramchandra saw a stone in the middle of the pathway, and the dust of his lotus feet touched that stone. Immediately, Ahalya resumed her beautiful form, and with folded palms she surrendered her life at the lotus feet of Sri Ram. She offered her obeisances again and again and again. She surrendered everything, and then she offered a prayer. She said, the only benediction I ask of you, Lord Rama, the only benediction I ask is let my mind never, ever, ever forget you for a moment. Let me always be absorbed in remembering your lotus feet. For all eternity, let me always remember and never forget you. I do not care for heavenly wealth. I do not care for mystic powers. I do not care for any of the pleasures of this universal creation. I don't even want liberation. I only want my mind to constantly be fixed on your lotus feet, and let me forever chant your glories. Lord Sri Ramchandra granted that benediction to Ahalya. And in giving her that benediction, he gave her the ultimate perfection of life, Krishna Prema. At that moment, Gautam Rishi appeared. He was very happy. Ahalya spoke to Ram. She said, actually, my husband's curse was not a curse at all. It was the greatest benediction of my life.
Because great souls are always compassionate. Even when they appear to be angry, they're actually just showing mercy upon the object of their emotions.
Ahalya had a little sinful propensity in her heart, and that overcame her. But Gautam Rishi gave her the process by which she could be completely liberated from all anartas by fixing her mind on Krishna, on Ram. So yes, Gautam Rishi, whatever he did was out of the greatest love for his wife and even Indra. That is the nature of a great soul. So Gautam Rishi and Ahalya, together, they spent all of their days in constant service of Lord Sri Ramchandra. Then Lord Ram and Vishwamitra Muni entered into the province of Mithila. Should I continue or end here? Ajay, should I continue? Anil? I'll continue as long as you don't go away. A few more minutes. So, when they entered into Mithila, immediately they saw the beauty of this town. So beautiful, so opulent, incredible. And when Maharaj Janak heard that Vishwamitra Muni had come, immediately he came out to greet him. When he saw the two princes with him, his heart was absolutely charmed with love for them. Vishwamitra Muni Janak Maharaj brought beautiful golden thrones and sat Vishwamitra Muni, Ram, and Lakshman on them. Then the king himself very humbly and sincerely washed the lotus feet of Ram, Lakshman, and the great sage. Then he began to offer them beautiful gifts. In fact, he offered them his very life. He asked how he could serve them. Vishwamitra Muni explained that I have brought these two sons of Dasarath, Ram and Lakshman, to see the mighty bow of Lord Shiva. King Janak was so happy to hear like this. That evening, he just did every type of service to make them happy and told them in the next morning he would give them the vision of the bow. The next morning, Janak Maharaj went to meet Vishwamitra Muni. And he was thinking in his heart of heart, that Ram is the suitable husband for my beloved daughter. At that time, he brought them to a large assembly house. As Ram and Lakshman were walking to the assembly house, all the citizens of Mithila were gazing upon his beauty. And every one of them had only one thought in their heart. This must be the husband of Sita. No one else in all of creation is worthy of her hand in marriage. So they came into the assembly hall.
Janak began to describe the glories of Shiva's bow. He said that this bow, at one time, was the bow of Shiva. The devatas offended Lord Shiva by neglecting him. So in order to teach them a good lesson, he declared war against them. And he lifted this mighty bow that he had created. When they saw his anger, and they saw the bow that he was carrying, the demigods surrendered at his lotus feet and begged forgiveness. Lord Shiva was pleased upon them and gave the bow to the demigods. One of my great forefathers, whose name was Devarata, who was also known as Janak, he fought a great battle against the demons on behalf of the demigods. And the devatas were so pleased with him that they gave him as a gift the mighty bow of Shankar. Since that time, it has been kept here in Mithila. This bow is so formidable. I wanted to perform a yajna to have a child. At that time, with a golden plow, I was plowing the earth of Mithila to form a sacrificial arena. As the plow was turning over the earth, from beneath it, a beautiful golden female child appeared. She was born of the earth itself. This divine child was the very embodiment of all beauty and divine qualities. I brought that child home to my palace and raised her as my own daughter. Her name is Sita. She is the most beautiful, the most chaste, the most kind-hearted and generous of anyone in this whole creation. I vowed that to marry this child, one must lift this bow, string it, and bend it. But this bow is so formidable that hundreds and thousands of the greatest princes, kings of all various lines have come. But not a single person could even lift this bow. Most people cannot even look at it. It has such an effulgence that is emanating from it. Even the great Rakshasa king, Ravana, came, and he struggled for hours, but couldn't even separate the bow from the platform it lays on. But I am thinking in my heart that Ram may fulfill all of my desires by lifting the bow. May I bring the bow for you to see? Vishwamitra Muni gave his approval. 300 men, with tremendous amount of struggle and strain, somehow or other, pulled the bow into the arena. It was in an iron casing. When the casing was opened, an effulgence lit up the entire environment. They looked upon the bow. It was huge. It was formidable. It was covered with gold, silver, coral, precious diamonds, rubies, emeralds, beautiful designs of the various pastimes of the devatas in the heavens, inlaid in precious, precious materials.
Janak Maharaj appealed to Ramchandra, "Please, try to lift the bow."
Lord Sri Ram was very humble. He looked to Vishwamitra Muni, and Vishwamitra Muni gave his blessings.
The Lord wanted to show the world that without the blessings of the great souls, no one, whoever they may be, should embark on a significant activity in life. When Vishwamitra Muni gave his blessings, Lord Ram walked to the bow of Shiva. Meanwhile, Sita Devi and her maidservants were sitting on a balcony, watching. Upon seeing the beauty of Ram, with a complexion like a pure emerald, her heart melted in ecstatic love. In her heart of hearts, he was the only person she could ever accept as her beloved. But she saw his body was soft like a lotus, and he was so young, and the bow was so big and so hard and so heavy. Her heart was palpitating. Tears filled her eyes. She prayed from the very core of her heart, "O Ram, please lift this bow and accept me as your wife." This silent prayer permeated her consciousness. And Janak Maharaj and all the citizens of Mithila were in a similar state of consciousness, just praying, "Let Ram be the husband of Sita." It was a very suspenseful moment. Sri Ramchandra slowly approached the bow. With folded palms, he offered his pranams. And then he placed his very soft, beautiful lotus hand on the mighty bow of Shiva. There was absolute silence in the entire kingdom of Ayodhya. At that moment, practically nobody could even breathe. Janak Maharaja's heart was palpitating, Sita's eyes were watering, and everyone was immersed in prayer. Sri Ram very quickly lifted the bow over his head. And then wanted to see how heavy it was. He shook it over his head. Everyone was in absolute silence. Then Sri Ram put the bottom of the bow on the ground. Took the string of the bow, first tied it to the bottom, and then tied it to the top. Then, before everyone's eyes, Sri Ram pulled that string. The bow that no man, demigod, or even Rakshasa could even lift from the platform was now being strung by Sri Ram. He pulled that string until it became like one big effulgent circle, and then pulled it more and
The bow cracked in three pieces. When that bow cracked, it was such a thunderous roar of a sound that the entire universe shook, and the earth appeared as if it was having an earthquake. The sound of that mighty bow was so inundating that save and except Janak Maharaj, Ram, Lakshman, and Vishwamitra Muni, everyone of Mithila fell unconscious. And Sita. Tears flowed from Sita's eyes. Her desire, her prayer was fulfilled. When the mighty bow of Shiva broke, as soon as everyone came to consciousness and saw Ram standing there with a very humble, gentle smile on his face, there was tumultuous roar of Shri Ram Chandra Ki! Shri Ram Chandra Ki! Shri Ram Chandra Ki! Dasarath Maharaja's heart was dancing in ecstatic joy. He called for Sita to come down from the balcony. She held a beautiful garland of golden flowers in her hand. Whoever she placed that garland on would be her eternal consort. With Dasarath Maharaja's blessings, she very timidly walked forward, her eyes looking down to the ground. She came close to Ram and gazed upon his beautiful lotus-like feet. And gradually, her eyes came to his ankles, his thighs, his knees, his waist, his chest, his shoulders. And she glanced into his lotus eyes. For a moment, Ram glanced into her eyes. At that moment, when they glanced upon each other, the ecstatic, eternal love of their hearts was awakened. And very quickly she looked down to the ground again, very, very shy. And she stood there holding the garland, and she looked to her father, and her father requested, "Place the garland upon Ram." With her gentle hands, which were like the buds of flowers, she placed the garland of golden flowers over the neck of Lord Ram. At that moment, all the citizens of Ayodhya just bursted into an ecstasy of joy as they exclaimed, "Sitaram ki! Jai Jai Sitaram!" They were actually ecstatic. At least 1,000,000 times louder than this, they were chanting. Vishwamitra Muni gave his blessings. And then immediately, messengers were sent to Ayodhya to bring the good news to Dasarath Maharaj. And we will end our narration here tonight. I thank you very, very much. I would like to ask Shamsundar Prabhu to speak a few words, or as many words he would like. Because he'll be leaving next week for abroad, so we may not see him for 6 to 8 months. But it has been such a very great fortune and blessing to have his wonderful association over the past couple months. Let us offer our gratitude to him by chanting Hari Bol.
You've been describing all these wonderful magic pastimes of Sri Ram. I've been practicing a magic trick myself. Would you like to see it? Have to close your eyes for a second. Close your eyes for a second. This is my magic trick. I didn't know you had an opening here. Speaking after Radhanath Maharaj is like a little candle compared to the forest fire. But I watched the initiation ceremonies today with great realization, so I made a few notes. I was prepared for your surprise. Seeing all these bright, shiny, laughing new devotees today, these angels, it touched my heart in a new way. It's brought me to a level of realization, of Krishna conscious realization, that I have not yet experienced before today. And that's one of very, very, very great hope. The hope that the realization of Srila Prabhupada's dream for saving mankind seems now closer to me. It seems closer at hand than anything I had previously thought. You people, I hope you realize the spiritual power as individuals and as a group that you all have and that you can bring to bear on this world. Sometimes a fire in the forest, if the forest is very dry, the fire starts out very small, just a small flame, a flicker. Just like we were when we came to Bombay 33 years ago. There were only a handful of us staying in by the mercy of some householder, let us stay in his house. Very small flame. But once the fire gets loose in the forest, very quickly it starts to run and get bigger and bigger and bigger, and then maybe 1 hectare. But very quickly in a dry forest, the fire will explode and take off through the forest. And this is not measured like geometry like this. It's in a certain point, a forest fire is going like this, and suddenly it goes whoosh, and takes off like a comet. We seem to be at that point. I can see us taking off with all these hundreds and hundreds of new, such beautiful, perfect, angelic devotees. I'm leaving on Sunday after being here among you for the last couple of months. And I won't see many of you for a while. But I just wanted to say now that it's going to be very hard to keep me away from Mumbai. And as a sort of a, well, the love and kindness that you've shown me is more than I've ever received in my life from any source, from anyone. So it's kind of an excuse I had to create to have a reason to be here and somehow pay back some of the debt I owe you all. Recently we've been contemplating and making steps toward acquiring a huge field somewhere, a venue, perhaps Kras Maidan or Shivaji Park, someplace like that. And in December, we've been planning together, some of us, to hold the world's, ISKCON's largest public festival ever held. Something huge in Bombay. But the second, it will be the second Pandal festival. The first one was held in 1971 with Srila Prabhupada. So this is Prabhupada's 108th birthday anniversary. So if we have in December, we're still within the limit. We can call it the 108th year. And it will be the 33rd year since Prabhupada's children came to Bombay. So the idea has been growing in our minds, just like this forest fire, getting very powerful, that this event can, it will accomplish so many things. Number one, it will replace Srila Prabhupada on the minds and the lips of all of your countrymen. All over India, Srila Prabhupada will be recognized for the true role that he has played in saving mankind. He's India's greatest, the greatest saint of modern India is Srila Prabhupada. But we have to re-educate this country, that is the fact. So this Pandal program will be something wonderful, something huge, with all of the resources and all of your energies combined. There's nothing you can't do. This is just a prelude. This is just something small compared to what you can do, what you will be doing over these years to come. So my humble gratitude is to all of you, and especially to your spiritual master, and my beloved friend, His Holiness Radhanath Goswami, whom I love more than my brother. And he is truly one of Prabhupada's most beloved sons. Thank you all so much. All glories to all the assembled devotees. Hare! All glories to all the assembled devotees. All glories to all the assembled devotees. All glories to His Highness, His Holiness, Radhanath Goswami. And all glories to our dearly beloved Srila Prabhupada. Hare!
Thank you, Shamsundar.